download these things. This morning, however, pushes the bounds a little bit. We're going to be following a series for Advent, the four Sundays in the lead up to Christmas, a series called Advent Conspiracy. And there's a couple of pastors behind it, and one of whom wrote a sort of explanatory introductory sermon on the series. And I was just getting into it this week, and I thought, and then as I was preparing my own message, I realized, you know what, some of these really great ideas I'm coming up with are actual total ripoffs from that guy I heard earlier this week. So I just want to give him credit out at the outset instead of me kind of repeating that throughout the message this morning. And I encourage you to go to, I think it's adventconspiracy.com or .org, and it will explain a little bit more about what this is all about for us. So we are headed into Christmas time. We are kind of in it, aren't we? I was talking to Judith yesterday, going down, getting the stuff and shopping, and already, you know, you think about going to the city and the traffic and the busyness. 'Tis the season, right? And for us here now, as we find ourselves in the culture, time, and history we are, one of the big parts of Christmas, of Advent, is just all the getting together and all the food, right? The food. Like, I know that when I go visit my mom, there's going to be a couple things in the space of 2 or 3 days when I see her. She does this breakfast thing where she prepares it the night before, and it's got the ham and the cheese and the bread and the eggs, and she puts it in. And I know she does a thing with hash browns, also a lot of cheese involved there, maybe a bit of sour cream. And I know that one of my aunts likes to do this incredible homemade butter tart thing that she does, right? And my sister, the older of the two, not the younger one, but no, this part's important. My sister's makes some fantastic deviled eggs. So I've just, what I'm telling you now might just seem like trivial details, but in fact, it's kind of a confession. The weakness I have for these foods that I'm looking forward to. And you have yours, don't you? Some of you are going to know exactly what you're talking about. And isn't it true that we get to these foods and they're on the table and you think, oh, I've been looking forward to this? Of course, I'm. You know, it's nice to see all your family and stuff, but the food, right? Been looking forward to this. And isn't it true that we have a taste and it's so good? And then we have some more. And then what do? We have some more, right? And then maybe you get up and sort of waddle around a bit and you let things settle. And then what do? We go back and we have some more. And soon we have to pop a button on the top of the pants and slip a loop in the belt, and we have some more. And isn't it all of that moreness, even in 2, maybe 3 hours? You kind of forget that you just did all that more, and you go back for more and more. And it tends to be kind of a season of more, doesn't it? Whether it's food, or for some of us, we like to have snow in the same, you know, capacity. More of that would be good, and I'd like to spend more time in it, and more and more. There's a lot of things, in fact, that we like to have more and always more and more and more. For some of us, it's work, right? Work gives us that sense that I'm doing something important and I'm a value and I have a self-esteem when I feel like I've accomplished something. And so I don't just work at a healthy, normal pace, whatever normal is. I actually like to work more and more and more. For some of us, it's the internet, right? I'm just going to sit down, I'm just going to check Facebook for a sec. Do you ever just try that for a sec? Right? And then something happens to the space-time continuum, and then you look up, and it's 4 hours later, because it's always about just more. More. Oh, look at the cute kittens. Oh, they're dancing or doing their thing. And you think, that's great. And then more. And it just goes on and on and on. And no matter how much of that we get, all of those things, our appetites remain. Right? It just comes back. We live at a time when we think, well, if... And I should say before I continue that none of those things in themselves are bad, right? I mean, I can tell you for certain that the thing my mom does with the cheese and the hash browns is not bad. It's not a bad thing. The internet, it's not a bad thing. Snow, especially when it's deep and fresh, right? It's not bad. Work is good. In fact, all those things are good, and we could make a list of other things. So they're not in themselves bad, but we live at a time when we think, well, if some is good, then more is better, and a lot is best. That does seem to have a kind of logic to it, doesn't it? If some is good, more is better, and a lot is best. And that leads us to be just this sort of constant pressure or presumed direction toward always having more. And I think that's especially true at Christmas time. So this is this series, as I mentioned before we started, is called Advent Conspiracy. I wonder what you think of, or what sort of vibe you get off that word conspiracy. What comes to mind? Conspiracy. Just, hey? Spies, yeah? Government? Uh-huh, we see where you're coming from, Judith. Thank you. Conspiracy, spies, secrets, right? Weird theories, you know. Speaking of Facebook, tend to get a little of those kind of conspiracy theories up there, right? You get cornered over Christmas by that weird uncle of yours who's going to re-explain, you know, he didn't really land on the moon or whatever. Conspiracy, but it sounds a bit kooky. Is that what I mean when I'm going to say we're going to do a whole series for Christmas on Advent conspiracy? Well, really what the word means is about conspiring against something, some power or some system, right? Those who are deliberately working against or intending against a system or a power. And I think that's actually, I hope, as we'll see in just a bit here, that's pretty accurate for what the Christmas story is actually about. And that might strike you as a bit odd. Is that what Christmas is about? Conspiring and working against some power, some system? Does that sound super Christmassy to you? Because we think of Christmas, we think of, you know, the little scene with the cozy cradle and the cute little baby and all the nice animals and the angels. They're not maybe biblical angels so much as the precious moments kinds of angels, right? And they look, they got the chubby cheeks, and it's all so nice. And how does that have anything again in line with conspiring against some power, some system? I think one of the problems we face, especially if church has been your thing for a while, is that the Christmas story is so familiar to us, isn't it? Even if actually church isn't your thing, it's still a familiar story, right? We know the story. And when something is familiar, it becomes quite naturally comfortable. That's kind of a synonym for familiar in a way. We become comfortable with the story, and I'm worried that that comfort could possibly become an obstacle to actually seeing the story as it is. Did you know that comfortable can become an obstacle? Right? We are what you might call a casual dress church, I think. Usually if we invite a guest speaker who's never been here before, it's really easy to tell who he or she is when they arrive on a Sunday morning, because they're like way overdressed. Oh, you must be the new person. You must be from the city. Because we tend to be pretty casual. Like Michael, you know, comes up in his hoodie. Mark often wears, although unfortunately he didn't this morning, but the unbuttoned flannel shirt is the look, right? It's really casual, but you got to stop and ask sometime, where will this trend end? This trend toward casualness in church on a Sunday morning. I mean, it's good that people are comfortable. Personally, I'm most comfortable in my t-shirt, my boxers, and my business socks.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That might be an obstacle on a Sunday morning. You're most comfortable in that baggy, old, ugly t-shirt you got from your work several years ago. You know the one. With the curry stain. You're comfortable in that. You wear that on a Sunday morning? That comfortableness is likely to become an obstacle. Right? Are you with me on that, church? You see what I'm saying? You see what I'm saying? And isn't it true that our comfort level with the Christmas story could also become, just like that, an obstacle to us being able to actually see it as it truly is. Well, we are going to dive into that story. One of the most familiar starts to it is in Luke chapter 2, and I'd like to begin in verse 1. Luke chapter 2, verse 1. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. So we don't even have to go any further. Right off the bat, we can see that, well, there's Caesars, and there's an entire Roman world. And that this Caesar is issuing a decree that a census should be taken. Now, we would need to understand a little bit of the history here, that the entire Roman world of the day, when this story begins, was the biggest, largest empire that human civilization had ever seen. So it stretched at the time from India all the way to England. And that Rome had done this, it's this most remarkable political accomplishment through various military campaigns and engineering and really quite radical social cooperative types of arrangements with local rulers and governors. And the empire was massive. I can kind of imagine that one of the tricky things about such a massive and diverse empire would be keeping it all together, right? Hard enough time keeping the little conglomerate of Pemberton Community Church together sometimes, never mind a massive empire that stretches from England to India in the first century. And how did they accomplish that? How did the Roman Empire accomplish that cohesion at the time? Caesar Augustus. All of that needed unity and cohesion of the day was centered around this one person. Oh, I forget what his name first was when he became emperor. But when he became emperor, it'll come to me later, he changed his name to Caesar Augustus. Augustus meaning a glorious, powerful one. And so that what that role did for the empire at the time was provided the unity, that everyone acknowledged that this one was emperor. He is Caesar. He is the glorious, incredible, powerful Caesar. And it is because, even though we're all stretched out, even though we speak different languages and have very different cultures, different colors of skin, different values, we all acknowledge together that this one Caesar is the emperor. This is extremely important for understanding the Christmas story, as a matter of fact, that this one Caesar was the one who is providing cohesion to a vast empire. And we've talked about this before, the way at the time there was what we call a state religion. So it wasn't just a matter of saying, yeah, you Caesar, you're in charge, you know, bumper sticker on the donkey cart or something. I voted for Caesar. Well, that's not the sort of unity we're talking about. We're talking about the kind of unity that says Caesar is God. So there was a state religion that involved worshiping Caesar. As a matter of fact, this particular Caesar, Caesar Augustus, himself never described himself as God, but he was quite comfortable, for example, with the term Son of God. That people would be required and expected to worship or acknowledge the divinity of their ruler, and that that acknowledgement across that empire is what kept the whole thing together. That's the sort of powerful figure we're talking about here. And that was across all of those other differences. Worship of Caesar as our divine ruler. But we should also realize that even within a system, a state religion like that, the Roman Empire of the day was incredibly what we might call tolerant or pluralistic with respect to what other people could do with their superstitions or their spiritualities, this would be a word that we might be more familiar with. So what I mean is you could still go ahead and have your other gods. It wasn't the claim that Caesar was the only god. It's just that he was the most powerful and divine one. You could have your other gods. I mean, actually, many people did. Probably most people did. There were still the Greek gods of mythology in the air, as it were. There were all of the gods that were believed in by the various cultures and societies that the Roman Empire conquered in its expansion. They didn't say you have to stop worshiping them. They just said, yeah, go ahead, but Caesar is God over them. Do you see what I'm saying here, church? Do you see that that sort of pluralistic, tolerant vibe might even be a little familiar to you and I? That's quite acceptable for you to go on and worship whoever you like, but still need to acknowledge the ultimate superiority of Caesar. So how did that play out for early Christians? Be perfectly acceptable for a Christian of the day, and now I'm sort of obviously jumping ahead to a few years after when Jesus was born, but the Christians of the day could say Jesus is that God with no blinks from anybody's eyes about how that may or may not sound. Nobody would be concerned about the implications of that sort of claim. Christians could say, yeah, he's God. They could probably even get away with that. They just couldn't say that he was superior to Caesar. In other words, Christians couldn't get away, or anybody couldn't get away with saying Jesus is Lord. Because there were many gods, but there needs only be one Lord. Do you see? Do you see that, church? That Caesar is Lord. So to suggest that there might be somebody else who is Lord would be to deny the state religion of the Roman Empire. And which is a bit of a hard place for us to get our minds to, because what really, how upset could people be if you denied the state religion? Well, remember that that one state-endorsed religion of Caesar worship is what held the whole thing together. That Caesar Augustus, across all these diversities and differences, he's the one that we all acknowledge. Otherwise, how is this thing even going to keep working? So to deny the lordship of Caesar was to undermine whatever it was, that cohesive political structure, that social system that held the whole thing together. So it would have been perfectly normal, even somewhat boring, to say that Jesus was one among many gods. But it would have been absolutely radical to say that Jesus was Lord, King of Kings, and Lord of Lords. Which begins to explain why early Christians were considered conspirators. Now do you see the word actually makes a little bit of sense. Conspirators, even in the sense that you and I might use it, like political or social rebels. Those who would lead a rebellion, right? Disrupting that kind of a system was dangerous. And it was considered dangerous, by the way, not just by Caesar and his cronies, those in power, but actually by the whole culture would have considered that dangerous, because they would have thought, hold on a second. If you can't say Caesar is Lord, that's just going to undermine all this. That's just going to take all this apart, all this great stuff we're enjoying and benefiting from because of the Roman Empire. And here you are denying what keeps it all together. Which begins to explain, I think, why early Christians were executed, thrown in prison, treated horribly, because they refused to say that Caesar is Lord, but instead said Jesus is Lord. They were executed because they refused to participate in that unifying system that held it all together. They were considered anarchists. They were considered treasonists, unpatriotic, if you can't say Caesar is Lord. They were rebels. Christ followers of the time would say, you know what, Caesar isn't the one who holds it all together. As Paul said to the church in Colossae, it is through Christ all things have been created, and in him all things hold together. That sounds kind of like a cool thing to read in Canada in the 21st century, but in the Roman Empire in the first century, absolutely radical, rebellious, treasonous claim that put his life at risk, that all things hold together in Christ. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he, Joseph, belonged to the house and the line of David. This is something I came across this week, which I didn't really realize before, but Bethlehem, of course, maybe I did know that it was a small town, but did you know it was a small town roughly on a the transition between the mountainous area and the fertile agricultural plain. So basically Pemberton, right? Bethlehem was a small town. It was the sort of place where you couldn't get your groceries in a hurry because you go into the grocery store and everybody knows you. It was the sort of place where, you know, drivers would stop their donkey carts in the middle of the road to have a conversation with a pedestrian. In other words, it's a lot like Pemberton. It's the kind of place where everybody knows the mayor, not because he's the mayor, but because he used to run the local coffee shop. And everybody knows the local government official because that's where they get the strawberries and pumpkins from. That's the sort of place Bethlehem was. In other words, Bethlehem was the kind of place where city folk wondered, what do these people do that live here? Nothing must ever happen in Bethlehem. That's the kind of town it was. In fact, we know that for sure because the king in Jerusalem, King Herod, didn't even know about Bethlehem's famous history. So if we look at Micah, chapter 5, verse 2, but you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. That's the prophecy concerning this small town that people thought nothing ever happened in. That prophecy is written, by the way, something like 700 years before Jesus. If we go to Matthew, one of the other more famous versions of the Christmas story in chapter 2 as well, we read this. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem, and they asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." Now, the first thing I'd like us to see in this passage, this verse here, is Jesus was born during the time of King Herod. And then these Magi from the east, by the way, from the east probably was what we would call modern Iran or Iraq. These wise men come because they're familiar with the prophecies. They've seen his star. And so we have King Herod in Jerusalem, and these Magi come and they say, "We're looking for King Jesus, King of the Jews." And you've got to see right there in just two verses, this is not a cutesy little precious moments type of story. You've got somebody who's king, and then these wise men are looking for somebody else who's called king. How can you have two kings in two different sentences so close together? That should alert us to the fact that something is at play here. There's some danger. There's some conspiracy afoot. And these Magi from the east, they had to explain to King of Jerusalem about his own scriptures concerning the prophecies around the king that would come from Bethlehem. In verse 3, when King Herod heard this, he was super stoked to go meet Jesus himself. No, he was disturbed. And let me tell you, he was disturbed in more ways than one, Herod. And it says, he was disturbed in all Jerusalem with him. Now that's an interesting little tidbit, isn't it? It makes sense that King Herod would be disturbed. If you know anything about his personality and you hear about some other king coming up, you know he's going to be disturbed. But why do we read also that all of Jerusalem with him was disturbed? I think they could probably read between these lines just as we have. That why would somebody come and talk about King of the Jews and yet King Herod's sitting right here with his crown on his throne? So the rest of Jerusalem's like, oh, this doesn't sound good, right? This sounds like something's gonna get a bit crazy around here. This sounds like somebody's working on some sort of conspiracy or rebellion or there's going to be, this is going to just destabilize the whole region. They might not have put it quite in those terms. They might have just said, it sounds like change. How do you feel about change? No, but really, you know, you got your life, you got things kind of sorted, more or less. How do you feel about the sorts of big, wholesale scale change? Most humans, if we're honest, we're like, I might just give the change a miss. You know, slow incremental improvement, I like the sounds of that. But radical sweeping change, don't like the sounds of that. Which probably begins to explain why Herod was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him. You know, one of the bits of the story that we don't actually talk about that often around Christmas is what happened next, which is that Herod went to Bethlehem and slaughtered all male children under 2 years old. You know that part of the story, right? And so I'd like us to realize that what happened then, because the family of Jesus was warned that Herod was coming with swords drawn, what happened? What did they do? They became, and I'm going to go ahead and use this word deliberately this morning. The family of Jesus at that point in the story became refugees, right? They had to flee a violent tyrant. They had to flee incredible, widespread domestic violence. Imagine somebody in Egypt, to which they fled, by the way, saying, you know, why don't these people just stay in their own country? I don't understand why they have to come to our country. Maybe Mr. Egyptian didn't have a real clear grasp of the sort of violence that Jesus' family was facing in their hometown of Bethlehem, or the sort of character that Herod was. Now, I wonder if Jesus' family had all the right visas. They'd filled out all the right paperwork, if the embassy was open that day, if they'd come across a government bureaucrat that was willing to be cooperative or not, if they'd been properly vetted refugees. We could go on a little bit. Wonder how the Egyptians felt about this influx of refugees. Like, these people going to be taking our jobs, maybe? Can our social support system is it going to be overwhelmed with these refugees? Are they dangerous? Judean Bethlehemites. Suspicious. I just want to say, church, that the time of Jesus, in fact, the time when Jesus himself was most vulnerable, was an extremely violent and extremely dangerous time in history. And that is integral to the Christmas story. You see, God himself was conspiring against that very darkness. That's what Christmas is about. God himself was becoming incarnate, as it were, behind enemy lines, so that he could overthrow a whole system of darkness and death in his Son. Now, what's become of this rebel conspiracy today, 21st century Pembertopia on the other side of the planet? Are there still Caesars, Augustuses afoot here demanding our allegiance? Are there still systems of social cohesion that are somehow at odds with the purposes of God? Are there for you and for me today these things? I guess what I'm saying is, is the Bible relevant to your life? Is the Christmas story actually relevant to where you're at in your life right now? Well, I think it's probably obvious, but we live in a time and place where there is no explicit state religion. Nobody's asking us to worship Stephen Harper or Justin Trudeau, right? You know that, right? We don't... don't have to. But there is. Is there, if it's not that sort of in-your-face obvious, like you have to worship Caesar, is there still some other system in place, some way that holds us all together as a big, broad country with many different people? What is it that holds us together that provides that political and economic cohesion in our society? I'd like to read a quote from one of my favorite authors, Wendell Berry. He says this: "We seem to be living now with the single expectation that there should and always will be more of everything, including life expectancy. This insatiable desire for more is the result of an overwhelming sense of incompleteness, which is the result of the insatiable desire for more. This is the wheel of death, he says. It is the revolving of this wheel that now drives our economy. The more superficial and unsatisfying our lives become, the faster we need to spend. When you are skating on thin ice, speed up. Now, I hope you follow that. I mean, the idea that we have this emptiness inside, which our culture and our society says can be filled by consuming more, and it's that desire, that's constant consuming of more that actually, he says, even deepens that emptiness inside, which further propels us to consume more, and on that goes, and he calls that the wheel of death, and he says that the faster that goes, we're on thin ice, and when you're on thin ice, you skate even faster. And I think that he's on to something. That is the thing which provides that sort of social economic cohesion in such a diverse and different and large country of ours, that we maybe don't bend the knee to Caesar, but you and I, we live today in what we might call the kingdom of more. That more is Lord. And that we must, as it were, bow this knee, run on this wheel, skate on this ice in homage to more. We're not required to worship Caesar, but we're required to constantly consume. Remember what we said at the beginning, if some is good, more is better, and a lot is best. And around it goes. And by the way, you get on that wheel, you don't need a preacher to tell you this, but if some is good and more is better and a lot is best, then contentment will always, always, always be just out of reach. It will never come, contentment. Ecclesiastes 4:6 says, better one handful with tranquility than two and a chasing after the wind. One of the things this Pastor Greg, who's been behind this Advent conspiracy, just said in passing, which struck me as quite profound, is that, you sometimes get those labels on products that say satisfaction guaranteed. Well, on this wheel, this constant consuming wheel that we're on in this culture, it should actually say dissatisfaction guaranteed, because isn't it true? You get at home, you're thinking, man, this is going to be awesome. My life is finally complete. I've got this huge flat screen LED piece of awesomeness. And it is for like the first movie or two when you're completely zoned out and you're just absorbed in it, and it's wonderful, and your life is complete really at that point. But then it sneaks back in the possibility that maybe it isn't complete. And then you just sort of push that idea away. No, this is what I wanted, and I have it now, and everything is good now. And you go back and you try it again, and then that little voice gets a little louder. And then so you quiet that voice with something else. Obviously, it's the latest iPhone. And the voice quiets down for a little while, and on and on and on it goes, dissatisfaction guaranteed. Really, modern advertising is the institutionalization of covetousness. That we are told every day in a million ways that if you have this, you will be happy. Your neighbor has that. They're obviously happy. And by neighbor, I mean, look at the smiling people on the television. They're obviously happy. You should have that happiness too. In other words, why don't you go ahead and covet that thing? And when you get it, you'll just be great and grand. Or at Christmas time, it's if you want to pull on the parents' heartstrings or pocketbook, it's your kids will be happy if they just have this. And we think, yeah, you're probably right. I better go buy that. And then thereby train our kids to get on the wheel with us and chase after the wind. So here's the conspiracy plan, church. That we would rebel against that state religion. That we would rebel against that system. Conspire against that lie. That we would, in fact, this Christmas aim to, this is going to sound a little crazy here, spend less. Spend less at Christmas this year. So we've probably got some Fight Club fans in the room today. I want to read a We buy the things we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't like. I think that's from when they're on the airplane, the guy's having his psychotic break where he's becoming two people instead of one. And the Brad Pitt characters, you know, the soap salesman. You don't need to watch this movie, but this is... We buy the things we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't like. And in your case, it might be you're buying things you don't need with money you don't have to impress people you do actually like. But it's the same point, right? That we get on that wheel and around and around and around it goes. Now, you're probably thinking, wow, sweet way to spoil my whole Christmas, Pastor Paul. Thanks. Super glad I came to church this morning. Let's just Scrooge it right out, like, don't buy stuff for each other. Keep your money to yourself. Don't get gifts. No, that's not quite what I'm saying, right? There is more to this series where we sort of maybe consider some alternatives to just, you know, rampant consumerism. There might be some alternative way to do Christmas, right? But it starts with us going, you know, I'm not going to live or believe that lie that in order to be fulfilled, to be a good parent, or to get into this, that I have to constantly spend more and have more. That's where we have to start. And from there, I think, well, we're ready to think about the story as it unfolds. Now, how do you spend less? Well, I was driving in this morning with one of my kids, and they were saying, here's what I want to make for Uncle Danny. And here's what I was thinking I might try to make for Grandma. And you know, my kids are completely perfect angels. You know that, right? They should be held up as examples and ideals for all the world to see. No, that's not true. But you see what I'm saying, right? I hope you see what I'm saying. Like what about actually doing that? Instead of buying the $50 thing for your brother-in-law, who you're not super keen on anyway, make him like a half dozen butter tarts or knit him a hat. I mean, I hate just to point out the fact that in our culture, in our society, that's actually a radical step. If you do that deliberate and you say, no, the reason I'm doing this is so that I'm checking out, I'm opting out of the official state's cohesive system power that means I've got to spend in order to participate and be one here. So I'm gonna be generous, I'm gonna give a gift, but it's not gonna be part of that system. I still remember when Mel and I were dating and she brought me along to her extended family's Christmases. What a terrible experience. You know, the young man trying to make impression and there's all these aunts and uncles around analyzing me and looking at me and asking me questions. But anyway, that's not why I brought it up. The reason I brought it up was because one of the Christmases was very memorable because Anne knit things and Tina made this homemade Bailey's and Adrian built things out of wood and Bernie lived near the water. He had these driftwood sculptures that everybody got. And aside from the fact that I was terrified the whole time and trying to keep up this good impression thing, it was actually a very profound experience, a Christmas, a memorable. I mean, that's 20 years ago, right? That it is possible to do things like that and actually still have a lot of meaning and generosity and gifts. That isn't it true sometimes we just get caught up in things? I have conversations with my own adolescent kids about getting caught up in certain social things. I mean, the cliche is the spliff's getting passed around and your friends are doing it and, you know, you just get caught up. Maybe in advance you thought, no, I'm not into that, but in the moment you get caught up. Or maybe something a little closer to home is you have your wine glass, but it just magically keeps getting refilled. Who's doing this? Where's this coming from? I don't know. There's like some fairy, some nymph coming around and refilling my wine glass. And next thing you know, you just got caught up in it. And isn't that the case with other things I mentioned at the beginning? Work, recreation, the internet. Do you ever try to go into Walmart and just get that one thing? Or Home Depot, I just need to get the thing, the little, and you walk out because you got caught up in it, right? And how often do we just get caught up in the wheel, especially at Christmas time? My mom does this every year. Bless her. She says, you know, we're just not going to buy much for you guys this year. We're just going to go a little softer. And I'm like, that sounds good, Mom. You do that. But then, right, you know, then it's like 2 days before Christmas. And I think what happens is she just snaps. She's like, there's not enough stuff under the tree. The kids are coming. And she just goes out and, I mean, that's how old I am. That's the charge. That's the credit card movement. Right? We don't do that anymore, do we? And it was good intentions, right? After that last minute, you snap, you get caught up, and away it goes, right? I wonder, church, if we could try to just conspire against that this year. That we could actually be rebels against that pressure, that system, that getting caught up in. See, in this kingdom of more in which we live, there's no Caesar with the golden garland and the toga who's saying, you know, you've got to call me God. There's none of that. But everyone has to act as if more is Lord. So this Christmas, here's the conspiracy. More is not Lord. Jesus is Lord. Amen.